St. Louis Aragon.
It's January 29th, 1986, and I'm Dan O'Neill, and I'm with John Burns. This is our second reel, and we're going to talk today more about some of the research he's done in mainly the northwest of Alaska for the last 25 years or so.
Yeah, my fieldwork started when I was a graduate student here at the University of Alaska with the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, and that was summer of 1960, and it's continued to the present. My first field involvement was on my master's thesis had to do with a study of mink in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. By way of background, the mink from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are the most valuable and highest quality mink produced anywhere in North America. They were very abundant, are still very abundant, and they were a very important source of income for trappers on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Again, I mentioned the other day that three people really influenced my philosophical mindset as a student. And I think that first field work that I first got involved in was probably the most extreme as far as different conditions to which a boy from the East Coast would be exposed. And that played a major role in my thinking from the first time I started working down there. As you know, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is a relatively densely settled region, considering that the residents were hunters and gatherers. A lot of people, Yupik-speaking people, divided more or less into three sort of groupings based on annual activity patterns. The coastal folks living off the sea, those along the major rivers, the Yukon and the Kuskokwim, major salmon streams, and those living out on the tundra. Examples of the latter were villages, people from the villages of Kasigluk and Nunapichuk. And of course, when I got there, consolidation of villages had occurred for many, many years. So the smaller extended family type settlements had sort of pulled together into larger villages. That time, 1960, dog teams were still the mode of winter transportation. Hunting, fishing, gathering was still the primary pursuit. There was no infrastructure, as came along later on with the regional corporations and the nonprofit corporations and the large, by comparison, greater employment of people in government service jobs. They were just living off the land, some commercial fishing on the rivers during the summer, and subsistence fishing, mainly down there fishing, with some hunting on the tundra villages during the rest of the year. My work was based out of the two communities on the tundra, which were, as I said before, Kasigluk and Nunapichuk. To use some slang, I knew nothing from nothing except about mink, nothing about people, nothing about how to get around in that country. My first real opportunity involved a gentleman who was at the time working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Mr. Ray Tremblay. Tremblay is a very interesting chap. He's since written two books after his retirement. I don't remember the exact titles of them. I think one is Tales of an Alaskan Trapper, and the other one is, his experiences as a game warden in Alaska. Anyway, the work was mostly with local trappers in the winter, and it was truly an eye-opening experience. Remember that the folks down there, especially at that time, communicated almost entirely in their own native tongue. I knew none of that, and it was sort of learning about how to live by watching and doing. And there were some really humorous occurrences. I remember working very diligently trying to pick up a few keywords, and I asked a young boy that I was walking down the path in Nunapichuk, what that was, pointing to a dog. And I expected that he would tell me what it was in his native tongue, and he was taken aback by such a question about the obvious, and he looked at me after I asked him, "What is that?" And he says, "That's a dog, silly." But the fall of the summer of 1960, I spent down there, very familiar with small boats, having grown up in a coastal town as a boy. And my work was live trapping mink, tagging them, releasing them, and then through subsequent recaptures by trappers in various places, studying such parameters as movements, that sort of thing. And in the winter, or in the fall, which really was the most interesting to me personally, I worked with an old gentleman from Kasigluk and joined him and his partner on a trap line. And every day was truly a learning experience. The dog teams were small. I was in much better shape than I am now. And I could put my gear, which was minimal, on the sleds with their gear, and I had to trot alongside the sled, and it's tough going all day long. The camps were out towards Baird Inlet, and they were semi-subterranean, very small camps. They were dug into the ground, made with locally available materials, including just shrubbery and straw on top of a sort of a frame overlaid by tundra moss, and then chinked with mud in the early fall, and then snowed upon. They were very snug and very tiny, and we did everything inside of those, you know, process the animals that were caught, live, sleep, eat. Really interesting. I found then that many of the things we discard, throw away, really had some use to folks that didn't have those things. Everything from the milk can that you punched a little hole in and filled with seal oil and stuck a piece of string in there for a candle, to Blazo cans that became the camp stoves. Really very, very interesting. There are lots of things I never did learn. I never did learn at first how, just by rote memory, they could navigate in that country in the kinds of weather that we did, because, you know, we tend to study the written word or use instruments like compasses, and they had the most keen appreciation for subtle nuances of the things that surrounded them. And I was forever looking. On a clear day, you could always tell generally where you were going and things like that. But the weather down there is kind of overcast, and I would never know from one moment to the next when I first started out whether I was going north, south, east, or west. Of course, you learn in a hurry, and I was just a sponge. I was certainly taking in far more than I was ever able to share in those years. The big project, the biological project, was to understand the ecology of the mink in that habitat. And there was absolutely optimum habitat. What supported such large numbers of such highly valued mink? They were huge, uniformly colored, very valuable. And I was interested in all aspects of natural history, you know, what constituted marginal habitat, good habitat, very good habitat, what affected their productivity, what they ate, how long they lived, how old they were when they became sexually mature, all the basic biological questions relative to a resource that's heavily exploited. I keep saying that experience in what, by comparison to the coastal areas and the areas further north, seemed to be resource-wise impoverished, was striking. In fact, it wasn't impoverished, as is clearly demonstrated, if by only one thing, the number of people that YK Delta supported. But you had to like fish. You certainly had to like fish. We fished for blackfish, for our dogs, for ourselves, for oil to put in the little can that we put the string in to make light. We fished for needlefish, about the smallest fish I had ever eaten up until that time. We fished for whitefish, we fished for pike. We fished for mink and muskrats. Most of the trapping was done with modified fish traps and chopped holes through the ice and set them in the water. And, you know, again, somebody like myself without any long term exposure and experience, wouldn't even be able to pick out a logical site at which to set a trap. It was truly a period of the beginning at the very bottom of the learning curve, and everything was new and fascinating. And that's kind of a romantic view of it. From a practical point of view, it was very early on, it was extremely obvious that I was working among a group of people that for many generations had accumulated a body of knowledge and an array of technology that was exceptionally well suited for that particular region. One of the main problems I was in fact working on was that the regulations of the old territory and the new state prohibited the legal use of what I generically refer to as fish traps for capturing mink. The Eskimo name for those traps was Taluyak. And it was illegal, and most of the people, including Ray Tremblay himself, the fellow that first introduced me to the area by flying me around for almost 2 weeks to pick out a study area to meet some of the people. He did take me under his wing and show me around and sort of point me in the right direction. But he himself was questioning the wisdom of outlawing a method that was ideally suited for harvesting mink in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Remember, that is tundra country. It's open, subjected to strong prevailing winds, drifting snow, and mink reside primarily along the river systems. So you can imagine, just thinking back in your own mind, what it looks like. What a small stream or lake margin looks like in the tundra country is completely drifted over. And the people were still using fish traps, and it was illegal. My studies of the natural history, ecology, and productivity of mink were really intended to make eventually some recommendations as to whether such an efficient method of harvest was truly detrimental to the resource. And as it turned out, my conclusions were that harvesting strategy was not detrimental, and in fact, one of the satisfactions I had early on was that my master's thesis resulted in a change in the regulations with regard to harvesting. But that was the short-term goal. The long-term goal was to understand the mink.
Describe that trap.
Well, if you there are several examples in the University of Alaska Museum. These are split willow funnel type traps. One end is round with a funnel going into it. The other end is all of the sticks that make it up are tied together. So it's a funnel type trap. The mink traps were made out of 1-inch mesh chicken wire. They were exactly the same design. They had the funnel, they had the trunk, and they were pulled together at the back. And they were set, as I said, under the ice in favorable locations, and then packed around them were willow brush, not the stems so much, the main stems so much as the branches. And in fact, it created an attraction for fishes, primarily blackfishes, that were digging all around these piles of brush under the water. And the mink feeding on blackfish would go into these traps. Their efficiency was based on the fact that, unlike a steel trap or a snare or a modern body trap like a conibear trap, the animals could keep going in there and they would drown. And I remember one time picking up one of the traps and it had 6 mink and 12 muskrats in it. One trap. In a very favorable location, of course. From the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, I went to Nome with an income, because I was then employed, and work was on primarily walruses in the first years. And the contrast was incredibly striking. It was striking from the standpoint of the annual activity cycle of the different groups of people with which I worked, and there was a very great diversity of groups of people. The amount of time involved in the annual cycle in harvesting activities, the amount of time and therefore the evolution of customs with regard to the ivory carvers and the dancers of the Bering Strait region, and just a whole different focus and different technology, you know, to go from the small, tiny little boats in the, of the tundra people used to check nets for pike and whitefish in the summer, to the big ocean-going umiaks of Bering Strait was really very interesting. Again, I started out on the very bottom end of the learning curve. This region, the Bering Strait region, to me remains one of the most fascinating in the world. I mean, you have to conceive of Bering Strait as a very narrow corridor connecting the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea, through which everything that migrates north and south passes, and it's a spectacular place. I'm sure there are other places like it in the world, but I haven't viewed them. Whether it's from the standpoint of seabirds, marine mammals, or people, it was just absolutely fascinating. I think one of the real interesting things about the Bering Strait region were the differences among the different groups of people. The island people of King Island and Diomede, those very small islands with essentially no terrestrial fauna or flora, were incredibly specialized and very efficient. And then you get to the bigger island landmass, St. Lawrence Island, very different culture, very different nuances, if you will, to the exploitation of resources. And then the mainland communities on the coast and away from the coast. And it was just overwhelming and fascinating. And it was the same sequence over again. We didn't have ice-reinforced research vessels, still don't have an adequate ice-reinforced research vessel, and there were people who were involved intensively in harvesting marine mammals in the early years, primarily for subsistence purposes, and then as the years passed by, for a combination of subsistence and more direct economic harvesting for economic reasons. Since there were no research vessels, and since there were so many animals being taken, those harvested animals became mostly the sources of the specimen material with which I was working to, again, look at basic natural history and ecology, the same basic kinds of questions. How long does a seal live? How fast does it grow? When is it born? Under what conditions is it born? What kinds of natural mortality factors is it subjected to? How old is it when it produces its first young? How frequently does it produce young? You know, just all of the basic questions that one has to know the answers to if you're going to do an acceptable management of two things: ensuring the health of the animal population first and foremost, and ensuring abundance at a level where the required levels of harvesting can be pursued. It was really very interesting. And I think the point I wanted to make was that in the early years, most of our biological sampling was dependent upon subsistence hunters. And in the course of the learning process, the first things to be adapted into my own methodology were the procedures, techniques, and to the degree that it was possible for me, the understanding of the surroundings to use their technology to fill in gaps. I mean, gaps relative to the timing of collections or to the locations of collections. The sampling at the major villages. Again, I told you once before that Antarctica is intriguing, but not near as intriguing as Alaska, because it lacks that one dimension which so fascinated me from the very beginning, and that's the involvement of local people. But at this point, I think it's important to say that what little success I may have achieved in many of the studies that I undertook is owed in very large part to not only the cooperation of communities and allowing access to animals they harvested, but a few key individuals that sort of signed on voluntarily or sometimes cajolingly coerced as not only incredibly competent assistants, but certainly excellent teachers. And a few people stand out in my mind. And one is Anthony Kuzuna, who's a King Islander, Edward McToyock, also a King Islander, Vernon Sloako from St. Lawrence Island, Albert Ayahuc from Diomede, and others. And I think that's, I can't speak for other investigators working, doing the kinds of things I do, but it's the contributions in many, many ways of the local folks who were curiously interested enough to be willing very much to help. And it was also very interesting to come to appreciate the body of knowledge about the surroundings that the people had, especially the hunters. I realized very early that much of the information that they were obtaining and storing away for very practical uses to make a living was acquired in the exact same way that I acquired mine, by watching, by registering, documenting, eye on paper, they mentally. The seasonality of all kinds of events, and they were very astute observers. We often disagreed with regard to our interpretation of things, but that's neither here nor there at the moment.
Imagine they had an oral documentation system too, right?
Well, I think the oral system that was so important to them, the answer to your question is definitely yes, more than definitely yes. And I remember an instance in my own career where I had spent probably 2 or 3 evenings every week from the time the ice came. This is in Nome, and it was with King Island folks, so that was in mid to late November, until the ice left. That's in June. Listening, being talked to, and watching. Listening to the stories. That's a very interesting thing. These were passed on in the form of recounts of the day's events after hunt. Remember, until relatively recently, among the King Islanders, this clubhouse, the community hall, was a very, very important focus of social activities. The men worked there during the days when the weather was not good to hunt. During the evenings, they danced there, they gathered there, and they were constantly, unlike us, we will pick up a book and go upstairs and sit down and read it. And they would get together and just either joke with each other, have various kinds of contests with each other, but mostly talking, recounting, as I started to say, the day's events, recounting instances that happened in the past and how those instances were successfully dealt with. And they were all lessons. Remember, the King Islanders were the absolute, unfortunately I use the past tense, but it's true, were the very best hunters in all of northern Alaska with respect to the drifting ice. And if you go back and look through what little history is written about them, you'll come to realize that a significant proportion of their adult males perished either by drifting away in the ice or during hunting accidents, mainly involving kayaks, hunting walruses and bearded seals. But they were still very, very successful, very good. And it so happened that I and this gentleman I mentioned met a series of circumstances in which we were cast adrift, and I could recall vividly almost every lesson that was pertinent to that, and I could see it put into practice, if you will, by Anthony and myself, from very major things, like your hunting bag amongst the implements contains a piece of bearded seal skin intestine about 1.5 feet long, tied off at both ends, and it's just there. And I've used it only on that one occasion, and that was to put fresh snow in, tie it like a bandolier inside your parka so that you always had not only water but relatively warm water. How to walk on the very thin ice, how to do all manner of things. Just when you sit down to rest, make sure you do very simple things like like untie the bottom of your hunting pants and your mukluks and make sure that you're not stopping circulation anywhere. Just, you know, I couldn't sit here and recount all the little subtleties that were a part of the everyday experience, if you will.
I thought it was interesting how you said we would go grab a book and go upstairs. It's almost as if they're doing that in a non-literate culture. They're going down and having the equivalent of a book.
It's exactly the same. I don't think it's almost the same as. I think it is the same as. It's conveying information, knowledge, or just whatever. And it goes to storytelling, to joking, to telling fables, to all aspects of it. Remember, information was conveyed verbally. We've gotten away from that.
Particularly with satellite TV.
Yeah. Well, as I think as you can see, the fascination for me has been, is, and I hope will continue to be, this nexus between a very, very fascinating group of people, a dunce in my own case when it came to really what I knew and know, even after 25 years of exposure, and trying to accomplish my professional goals within that bigger setting. I would do every bit of it over again. A lot of the technology we used eventually to pursue different goals. When I got away from primarily obtaining a large volume of sample material from the subsistence hunting villages, the other questions had to do with the broader areas of the Bering and Chukchi Sea to which coastal-based hunters had no access or were not harvesting these animals in a time frame from which we needed material to fill out the picture. You know, what's happening along the ice margin in southern Bering Sea? In 68, starting in 1968, there was a vessel, which is still here, used to belong in those years to the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, was the Alpha Helix research vessel. Supposedly ice-strengthened. It was ice-strengthened, but it certainly was not designed to work in the ice. It had a very sharp prow and tuna clipper type hull. But Dr. Per Scholand, a very great physiologist, took that vessel into the southern regions of seasonal sea ice in conjunction with one of the older icebreakers, the Northwind, and I started working from available platforms of opportunity and got involved. To the ultimate involvement was with the Polo class icebreakers, which for my work are absolutely unsuitable. You can't even get over the side and onto the ice. They're just real white elephants from the standpoint of the kind of stuff that I'm doing. But went through this natural evolution of looking and studying things a little bit further afield because we had such a good base of background material from certain times of the year and certain locations. That evolution was very interesting too. Different exposures to different parts of that Bering and Chukchi Sea marine ecosystem, and the evolution of the shipboard work, in which I involved my Eskimo assistants to the maximum extent that I could. And it went from the small research vessel, the Alpha Helix, working in concert with an icebreaker, to the larger icebreaker, the Glacier, and then the opportunity to conduct research from Coast Guard icebreakers is sometimes very limited. I never had a mediocre cruise. I either had a few very, very successful ones, or more often, very marginal or poor ones. And lots of things happened. We got to, as I said, 68 started the small research vessel work. 71 working on the Coast Guard iceberg Glacier, a wonderful, successful cruise. And then in 1972, there was an international incident, a favorable one, that affected work for many years after that. Presidents Nixon of the U.S. and Podgorny of the USSR signed an international agreement on protection of the environment. and that was in the earliest days of détente. And it called for an exchange of scientists and scientific information in many forms and in many fields, atmospheric sciences, earth sciences, etc., etc. Well, I was involved in the marine mammal group, involved in marine mammal work. We had struggled, Dr. Fay particularly, before me and I subsequently, and in concert with him, to establish and maintain some sort of an exchange with Soviet investigators who we had never met, whose works we had only read about, and who we occasionally corresponded with, and very occasionally exchanged papers at international meetings. That agreement, the international agreement, cooperative agreement on environmental protection, in the marine mammal subgroup, we started off running. I mean, the Soviets were, we share a common resource. You have to look at the Bering Sea as a lake mutually shared by the Soviet Union and the United States by and large. And they're very dependent upon it, and our residents also dependent upon it. So we had many common interests, and we also had an advantage of having already established some communications. And I think more importantly than anything was the fact that the scientists, Dr. Fay particularly, could read and understand Russian, and the Soviet scientists involved in the Marine Mammal Group could read and understand English, so it was not difficult to communicate. The agreement was signed in 72. In 1973, two Soviet scientists joined us in Alaska, working on seals in the Aleutian Islands and in the northern Chukchi Sea, a very long cruise, also involving the Alpha Helix again. That exchange program has continued very actively in at least the area of marine mammals. In fact, in March and April of 1985, just last year, I and other American scientists spent 2 months on a Soviet sealing vessel, again working on materials that were obtained in regions of the Bering Sea that we could not, and at times of the year that we could not have any access to them from coastal communities.
What was that like? Give an idea what it's like to be on a boat with the Russian counterpart.
You know, ship life the world over is quite similar. That's one real commonality among sailors, seafaring people. You know, the vessels do the same things. They float. They're long and narrow, and the quarters are confining, and the days are long. The work is hard. It's sort of. I'd start out by drawing another analogy. For me to go on a vacation to a city in Western Europe is like going into any American city, with the exception that you hear a different language spoken. If you're a city creature, you can find your way around cities. And going on ships are sort of the same thing. The routines are the same. They stand watches at about the same sorts of things. The officer corps and the sailors have the same sort of rank system. Things are very, very much the same. The only things that were different, I think, were, again, you know, the food is different, the language is different, and of course the psychology or philosophies shared by people from different nations is very different. And I didn't feel like it was anything really strange.
Do they have a political officer?
Oh, yes. I think every vessel with any complement of any size complement has the first officer, who is the commissar. And you've got to understand that in contemporary Soviet Union, everything is totally government controlled, and whereas 20 years ago or 30 years ago we had catechism classes in class, they have catechism classes now, and it has to do with the politics of the Soviet Union. Yes, his job is as an information officer, kind of as an executive officer helping the crew, and as a teacher. They held classes regularly.
Did much of that come down toward you guys? Did there any subtle indoctrinations or overt?
I have heard others talk about their experiences and, indicate that they felt different kinds of pressures. I don't know why in my own case. We were there to work, and the Russian scientists were there to work. We worked very hard, and the crew worked very hard. We had many heated debates, but there was no concerted effort to instill ideological dialogue. In fact, I think the freewheeling debates sort of thwarted that sort of stuff. We would
political systems.
Debated life. I mean, what do you do after a long, hard day's work when you have little time before bed, you're sitting down relaxing, drinking hot tea or occasionally bottle of more vodka, and there were numerous questions and answers and debates. Very basic questions like, it's hard for a Soviet to perceive things we take for granted, owning a piece of land, owning your own house. How much do you make? How can you buy a house? How much does a car cost? Can you get parts readily? What can you buy in the store? What is TV like? The Soviets know more about us than we are willing to learn about them in an abstract sense. And much of what they see is the worst we have to offer, in a sense that they read about the ills of a capitalist system. They read about the aggression of the United States, and they're aware of it. Their interpretation may not be as we see it. I remember one long evening debate about discussion, argument, heated discussion about Afghanistan. And of course, you can't consider Afghanistan without having the Soviets bring to light Vietnam. And no matter how you look at it, there's two governments supposedly working towards very different goals, but the end result is the same. It's the occupation of another country, and the Soviets, Russia, has been threatened in reality or in their imaginations from time immemorial. They always feel like there are outside threats, and they occupy Afghanistan to achieve a friendly, in quotes, buffer between the outside world and the Soviet Union. But they view our involvement in Vietnam as strictly colonial imperialism and expansionism. No matter what you call it, the result is sort of the same, but it gives you some insight as to how things go on. And, we both sit back, and the fellow that's indoctrinated that what's being done in Afghanistan is totally proper and what was done in Vietnam was totally improper, you get to these points where things start to register, which wouldn't normally. I guess one of the shortcomings in all of my involvements was that I tend to be kind of a humanist, if you will, and an exposure to the Soviets was intriguing in very, very different ways than was exposure to Native Alaskans. And it's been part and parcel of my work for 25 years. It's been fascinating. Incredible opportunities.
How did you find the Russians in terms of the quality of their science, how well they were trained, how knowledgeable they were?
They are ahead of us in certain aspects and certainly far behind us in others. In the traditional scientific involvements, like studies of helminthology, like traditional morphology, the things that do not involve lots of sophisticated gadgetry, they're fine, very fine. We're head and shoulders above them at this stage of the game. In technology, this very sophisticated physiological studies that involve all kinds of modern instruments, they just don't have access to, not at all. And you know, they feel that acutely, and they're working very hard on making sure they obtain that stuff. First obtain it, and second learn how to make it themselves. And there's a very different system in the Soviet Union. We seldom run across a Soviet citizen who doesn't speak another language. You seldom run across an American, in the lower 48 particularly, that speaks anything but English. And they're avid consumers of all available information. And that's not just accident. You know, one of the stories I was told was about Lenin. It had to do with languages and the edict that he passed down to subsequent generations of Russians, that it was their obligation to learn all about any people that they interacted with, any other groups of people. And the story was told how rapidly he learned English when he was in England and German when he was in Germany, and that was their obligation to do the same. Remember, he, up until now, is not openly considered a deity, but he's certainly very rapidly being deified, and his edicts are going to be the same as the edicts of any other religious leader. It was interesting. Back more on Alaska, I think one of the things that, again, has been sort of interesting to me was the traditional native technology in exploiting their environment, which we, I and my colleagues, sort of modified to our own needs. One of them had to do with these dogs we used to work on seals. You know, as especially in the eastern Canadian Arctic, when you see people in the complex coastlines of the high Arctic, they didn't hunt at open water leads. They hunted seals through their little breathing holes and camped out on the ice and all that sort of stuff. Well, they didn't find them by sight by any means, because those are underneath the snow, and they used to use dogs. And, you know, I have a soft place in my heart for dogs. Worked the first 3 years with dog teams until my wife wouldn't put up with them while I was gone so often. But instead of sled dogs, which are good for pulling sleds and good for finding occasional holes, decided to get a dog that was a good... I wanted a nose with a dog attached. I didn't particularly want a dog with a nose attached, and so we went through, tried to work with Springer, a Springer Spaniel. He was totally intractable, though he could smell incredibly the things at an incredible distance. Got back to the more tractable types of dogs, like Labrador Retrievers, and trained them to locate the structures of seals underneath the snow, and to do it in a very rigorous and continuous way. We had to have a dogs that were tractable to the point where they could live in camps where construction workers were, travel in helicopters. To put a dog in a helicopter means you have to train him to tolerate ear protection devices, noisy airports. You know, it's just kind of interesting. And again, you know, just the working with the dogs was interesting in and of itself. But beyond that, the use of the dogs as a method for getting on to the study that we were conducting was about the most efficient way we could approach it. The study that involved the dogs was one of trying to determine, at first, the impact of on-ice human activities in the Beaufort Sea on the distribution of ring seals. Were they displaced by seismic exploratory activity with all the noise and rumblings of heavy equipment and the sounds first of explosives, then of air guns, and finally, and until now, vibersize techniques? That's all a big racket. Noisy. And that's what we were looking at. And then we...
displaced?
To a very limited extent, only within very short distances of the actual human activities. And then we expanded the ring seal work using dogs to try and look at the entire coastline of Alaska from Norton Sound northward, determining what constitutes favorable habitat for adult breeding ring seals, where most pups, whether there were regional differences in use by ring seals in different reproductive conditions or in different age groups, and just fascinating. A lot of interesting stuff.
And was there enoughable breeding?
Well, certainly there are certain. We learned a lot more about not only the array of habitats that are used, but how different kinds of habitats are used. I think I started the last time we talked trying to explain something that's hard for people to comprehend, that you can look at this valley or the hillsides and see the different types of vegetation that grow on it, and then they're the result of different habitats, microhabitats, if you will, where drainage and exposure and soil type and permafrost and a whole array of other things interact to produce a certain plant community. And my analogy the last time we talked was that you look out to sea and you see this very great diversity from the land fast ice, that unbroken sheet that's firmly attached to the shore throughout the winter and early spring, to the shore lead system, to the drifting ice. And the drifting ice, just that habitat is highly diversified depending on whether it's exposed to crushing forces which drive it towards the shore and compact it, versus passing south through Bering Strait where these big flows become diverse. You know, it's not an accident that species like beluga whales and bowhead whales and walruses, who spend the summer in the far north, migrate south and occupy the Bering Sea. And the Bering Sea is, from a habitat point of view, incredibly different in the winter than is the Chukchi Sea, and both are different than the four more northerly seas, the Beaufort Sea and the Arctic Ocean. And those are the kinds of things that have taken my time and energy.
I was reading a little bit about how the retreating ice in the spring somehow generates plankton blooming and maybe adds nutrient to the sea bottom and maybe results in more clams and more walruses.
Yeah. Well, like the land, the primary producers in the ocean are plants. On land, they tend to be very large plants, going all the way to such things as sequoia trees, but they're very highly visible, multicellular, complex plants. In the ocean, they tend to be single-celled plants, the plankton. Diatoms, although there are kelp forests, you know, and there are all other kinds, but the majority of the primary production is phytoplankton. And you have three sort of generic types of habitats. You have the water column per se, occupied by an array of phytoplankton species. The sea floor, provided it's in the zone to which light penetrates, also supports primary producers, phytoplankton. And then you have this very interesting substrate in seasonally ice-covered seas, the sea ice. I like to jokingly refer to it as terra infirma. And it is a solid substrate, and you've talked to others that work with phytoplankton, but the epontic algae, and that's a technical term, that's algae that that live on the underside of sea ice, are, like other plants, rather specialized and highly productive, and they certainly contribute significantly to the overall annual productivity of the seasonally ice-covered seas.
And do you find a big effect on walrus populations? Or do they do better in those zones where the ice retreats seasonally?
Well, they only live in the seasonally ice-covered seas, not in the high Arctic that's permanently ice-covered. They are margin-type animals. Of course, they can live during seasons when ice is not present and haul out on land, as they do on the Walrus Islands in Bristol Bay and other places along the coast. But they are, you know, the majority of females and juveniles are very closely associated with the sea ice year-round, and therefore undertake rather long-distance seasonal movements. There are others better qualified to talk about the Bering Sea as a physical system, but it's sort of interesting. Remember that the walruses are not fish eaters. They live primarily on organisms that live in and on the sea floor. Most of those organisms are filter feeders, some are detritus feeders, and if you look at the physical system of the Bering Sea, you're looking at bivalve mollusks, clams, for instance, taking advantage of of a downstream effect in the Bering Sea, where you have very high production and productivity along the ice margin, and much of that productivity being precipitated out, if you will, from one reason or another, falling to the seafloor, being incorporated into these benthic communities, and then you have this critter coming along, feeding on these benthic communities.
That's real interesting how ice relates with biology.
Well, it shouldn't be surprising. That's probably one of the most overriding, dominating physical factors. And in again, in the north, although ice tends to be more obvious to us than permafrost, just think about how dominant permafrost is as a physical environmental factor. Incredibly so. It determines the depth of annual thaw, the depth of the active layer, the vegetation that can grow, tolerate it.
Hence the species that can...
Sure. I think the hardest thing for most folks to recognize is that you have the same sorts of dynamicism existing in those habitats as in the more familiar ones. It's no more unique in some respects. It's different.
What's the zone called where there are open water areas surrounded by ice?
Yeah, there are several terms relative to openings in the ice. The leads tend to be, leads are those openings which are long and linear in shape. Polynya is a term borrowed again from Russian, which means an area of open water completely surrounded by ice. And that's in its narrow sense. Polynyas, the ones of real importance, major importance, are those that are persistent polynyas. For instance, on the lee sides of the major islands and land masses, like Norton Sound, which is on the south side of the Seward Peninsula, and therefore, and in prevailing winds in winter, which are northeasterly and northerly, you have a system of very active ice dynamics where the ice is consistently blown away from shore and new ice is consistently forming. And the ice layer is thin, occasionally not there at all, great penetration of light or greater penetration of light. The Polynya systems in the Gulf of Anadyr, in Norton Sound, south of St. Lawrence Island, which is an incredibly important Polynya system, south of St. Matthew Island, south of Nunivak Island, you know, they're consistent, persistent, and regularly occurring. And you go further north, you have the same sorts of systems, but we're focusing this conversation more on Bering Sea.
Why are they important?
Well, for a variety of reasons. To what? To fish or to birds or to marine mammals? For instance, to birds, they're important because birds can't make holes through the ice to get at their food. And they're open water in which birds can easily forage, have access to the food, rest. To marine mammals, it depends on the marine mammal. So, they're adapted in all sorts of different ways. The ring seal, as I told you before, with regard to our use of dogs, is capable of living under extensive, unbroken, stable cover of ice, whereas the spotted seal or the ribbon seal and the bearded seal occupy mostly areas where the ice is disturbed. It's in motion in the drifting ice zone, where it's opening and closing. And around the margins of the polynyas and in the polynyas themselves, as I said, as dependable in their occurrence and repetitive in their occurrence, it's where animals can make their living without a high degree of risk. All mammals are air breathers. One thing they have is access to air, in addition to food, in addition to escape cover, whatever that may be for the individual animal. So these areas are highly productive and offer optimum environmental conditions, and they're very important.
So they're all making their living from the sea, but they all have to get out to breathe.
Well, have access to air. Whales never come out of the water, all the pinnipeds do. In fact, I referred to ice as terra infirma, and for certain functions like producing young, the ice is the platform on which they haul out and give birth to their young, nurture their young, undergo their own annual molt as adults. I often think in terms of comparing the diversity of marine mammals along in regions that are not seasonally ice-covered. For instance, take the area from Baja, Mexico to the Aleutian Islands. There are lots of marine mammals, and they're restricted to certain rookeries to which they go, but they occur in a linear distribution relatively close to shore. They don't go very far, and as soon as you move either south into the waters, ice-covered waters of the southern hemisphere, or north in the northern hemisphere, as soon as you hit the seasonal sea ice zone, you have a much more broader distribution of mammals. They're all over the ocean because they're always immediately over their food. They're always immediately over escape cover. They always have access to a place to haul out. So you end up with two things: higher numbers and a greater diversity of species.
Does the ice sheet roughly conform to the continental shelf?
In the Bering Sea, it does. The Bering Sea is, you know, conceptually a sort of a northern extension or embayment of the North Pacific Ocean, and it derives the majority of its water from the North Pacific, and it's almost evenly divided into a very deep basin and a very shallow continental shelf. You know, if you were to draw a line from Cape Sarachev to Cape Navarin on the Soviet side, that's a generalization because there are some indentations here and there. Everything north of that is the continental shelf, and everything south of that is basically deep water. So you have a warm, deep body of water to the south and a shallow body of water to the north. It's much easier to cool that shallow water. And by and large, the answer to your question is that the seasonal, the maximum, the average maximum extent of sea ice during late winter, spring in the Bering Sea coincides very closely with the shelf break.
And so then is one of the reasons maybe that the mammal distribution as you come north will swing further out to sea or away from the coast, is it dependent as much on the continental shelf as the sea ice?
Yes and no. Some animals are shallow feeders using the continental shelf. Those are the bottom feeders, like bearded seals, walruses, gray whales. Some do very well in the water column, and it doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference how deep the water is. They still do well. Bowhead whales fall into that category. You can't compare them just ice or not ice. There are other factors. You know, why does the bowhead whale nor the beluga whale not occur outside of areas of seasonal sea ice? You know, one could make a good case on food. One could make a good case on lots of things, including, probably as important as anything else, abundance of predators, nature of predators. But I think in answer to your question, the array of marine mammals have evolved to exploit all of the different ecological niches. They are highly diverse. They are no less abundant near the coast as away from the coast. They're different species near the coast, by and large, than far away from the coast. You know, if you look at the spring migration of bowhead whales, my God, it's right next to the coast when you round places like Point Barrow. And bearded seals come right into the coast as the shore ice breaks up in the springtime, very important source of food. I think what we're really getting at is this array, this big array of organisms, whether they be fishes or birds or mammals, function in different ways and exploit different ecological niches within these physical systems. And there is an array of these ecological niches, and that's why there's an array of different fishes, birds, and mammals.
A list of the important marine mammals.
Well, they're all important, and I couldn't give you the full list of 28 regular current animals that occur regularly, and up to 32 if you consider a few stragglers here and there. But the ones in the northern coastal zone clearly have to include bowhead whales, beluga whales, walruses, bearded seals, ring seals, spotted seals, occasionally ribbon seals. As you go south away from the ice, you're talking about sea lions, harbor seals, sea otters, and sea otters are going to be very important in Alaska because of the interesting relationship they have to fisheries and how they influence fisheries and human endeavors.
Then there's the whole array of small whales, the porpoises, harbor porpoises, doll porpoises, white-sided porpoises, the more distant water ones, and then the great whales, which I won't go through the list of, blue whales, fin whales, sei whales, etc., etc. But I think I gave you the more important animals that occur in the coastal zone, reiterating them: sea otter, sea lion, and harbor seal in southeastern Alaska, south central the Aleutians, and get up into the ice-covered regions. Ribbon seals, bearded seals, spotted seals, ring seals, beluga whales, bowhead whales, and of course in southeastern Bering Sea, fur seals to the Pribilovians, polar bears, I forgot, I probably missed a few.
Well, that's good. Let's see, let me shut this off a minute.